So I've read a book recently by Dan Siegel. I think it's a fairly new book. Let me see. I'm never sure. 2 years old. Took me a while. The book is called Aware. I mean, Awake. Awake. And what attracted me to this book was the cover of the book says, "The groundbreaking meditation practice." I was like, wow, this has been, going on just in our lineage for 2,600 years. So I'm interested in what is groundbreaking, and Dan Siegel, of course, is a psychiatrist. He's a physician, and I think he's a pretty extensive writer in mindfulness. So he's a practitioner. He's quite well known, and so it interested me. Like, I mean, it's not like he's unaware of practice. So it just I had to read the book, and he quotes in here William James. So he's talking about what is presence? What is it to be awake? What is the training of an awake mind, and how do we teach it essentially, and then also what comprises it? What does it look like? So he defines presence as being wide awake and receptive to what is happening, to whatever is happening. Wide awake and receptive. So, both of those things can be a challenge. I mean, we're good in our society at putting ourselves to sleep and going to sleep and escaping our experience, and we have a lot of skills for that. And I think part of that is because we are schooled in a way that requires us to suppress our natural sort of tendencies or ways of being. And so in order to suppress, we give up a certain presence. We allow our attention to be hijacked by some things or pulled instead of guided. So being wide awake and receptive. And that, of course, led me to think about, sometimes I think I'm wide awake, like I think I'm really listening. And then I realize I've missed the person. As if I didn't hear them at all. Like what they were intending to convey to me is something different from what I perceived. Or they perceived something I was trying to convey in a way so different from my intention that it made me self-reflect. How did I not see the impact of my action, my speech, on this person? And it happens often enough that I thought, what is getting in the way? So this book, this piece that he talks about in here about presence is being wide awake, and wide awake is sensing the mind itself, which is to say, knowing or sensing attention, right? Knowing, there is attention here. I am attending. I am aware. So that knowing of presence, in a sense, is a piece of it. And then in conjunction with that, sensing the objects of mind. So the activities of mind, which is my attention, if it's guided and I'm aware of it, right? So sensing the activities of mind and also simultaneously the object of attention. So in that way, we can develop skills in guiding our attention to objects that are wholesome, that fit our practice, that we want to feed our body minds with. We can put our attention not only on what causes survival, you know, enough food, enough water, enough house, enough shelter, whatever. But also we can put our attention on our activities, on how we, on our, on what guides our actions, our intentions. We can look deeply, as an object of attention. So my teacher Darlene used to say, where you put your attention is who you are. Now, my mother had a lot to say about various things that comprised who I was, like, what you eat is who you are. Who you're with is who you are. What you read is who you are. Aline was really a pro at this. Fill in the blank is who you are. But if you really think about attention, what you put your attention on defines essentially your consciousness in that moment. So assuming that we are guiding our attention and that it's not just being dragged around by everything, assuming we are sort of the master of our attention, so to speak, to me, essentially, that's what continuous practice means. You know, sort of being in charge of this light and where I shine it. Or not even I, necessarily, that's false, too. So it's hard to describe, but let me read this quote that from Siegel's book, where he actually quotes James, William James, who was the, you know, the father of psychology, of modern psychology. And, he, you know, James had one idea, and there was another guy named Lang who had a different idea. But this idea was quoted here, and I think it's really amazing. He says, William James said, the faculty of voluntarily bringing back a wandering attention over and over again is the very root of judgment, character, and will. No one is composui, master of himself, if he have it not. An education which should improve this faculty would be the education par excellence. But it is easier to define this ideal than to give practical instructions for bringing it about. So, I don't know, 2,550 years before, there was instruction given, and that instruction has carried right to us, sitting in our chairs and on our cushions and on our couches. It's right here in my little apartment, this right here, teaching of how to teach the mind to come back, to come back. You are all pros at this. You are experts at this. This is our practice. And William James reiterated it, you know, a couple centuries, a couple millennia, actually, after it was well taught. And I'm finding, as I read more and more of the current neuropsychological, sort of neurobiological, learnings that are coming out, and they're so helpful. Rick Hansen writes a lot about this. He wrote The Buddhist Brain. Many Vipassana practitioners are writing about this connection. But it is the same thing that the Buddha taught. So these teachings are not new. And somehow, it's very interesting to me that Buddha, 2,600 years ago, could simply get mad at his inability to get the answers he was seeking, get frustrated with that, and sit down and shut up long enough to reveal to himself all of this that we are now uncovering. He knew it because he taught it, and his disciples have been teaching it. You have been teaching it. Your friends, your teachers. This is, I feel, very much in the same field. It's really, I would consider it grounded in the teachings. So the issue that James was bringing up was the issue of learning to stabilize attention. That this capacity for attention that humans have, that really all sentient beings have this capacity. It's a survival function, partly. You know, you're grazing in the field, you're eating, you're all comfy, your herd is happy, and then all of a sudden there's a sound. Wham! Guided attention. Everybody in the herd. And figure out what it is. Is it safe? And then grazing, happy, right? So most of our lives we are designed as biological beings for most of our lives to be the grazing feature. The contentment. The comfort. But our modern societies have created chaos and constant demand and emails and voicemails and why didn't you answer me and did you get my email and did you get my email from last week and what if I also left you a voicemail and you know we have created constant alertness, very little grazing, right? Very little reflection, very little just hanging out with my herd, being comfortable here, being safe with my sangha, you know, with my herd. We have, that's so rare. And that's actually what we're designed for. So no wonder we have epidemic anxiety and depression and manic depression and mental illness of PTSD. You know, every kind of mental illness you could name is at huge proportions in our societies. And I feel we have really moved too far away from what we were built for, which is, you know, hanging with the herd and being safe and content and quiet. And then occasionally, wham, what's going on? We ought to survive, right? So it's not that I'm unalert when I'm grazing and with my sangha. I'm alert then too. But I'm not in this state of hyper alert, which is what I feel like our society calls for way too much. I don't know, maybe it's just me, and I do tend toward that. So I could own that. If you all tell me, hey, you moved away from Santa Cruz, it's you. I could go with that. But I think it's pretty endemic in how we are called to live right now. So what does it require to actually see. So I talked about being present or presence and guided attention versus pulled attention. It's just, you know, hijacked wherever it's going. The question is that I think he does a good job at addressing is what does it actually take to see? Given that I come with my bias and all my past associations and I project onto the present, you know, what I think I already know and all of that. What do I need? What are the factors there? So open receptivity, he says, open receptivity. And to me, those are synonyms for Zazen. That's what we practice in Zazen. It's not easy, but we at a certain time sit ourselves down and get our bodies stable, aligned and still. And in that stable, aligned and still state, we do nothing. We do not act. And that, other than to come back, bring the mind, bring the attention back here, right here, to the breath, to the body, to the sounds, to whatever it is that your practice is to return to. But Zazen is about returning. And Darlene would say, we're building the returning muscle, right? Building that muscle. So the more we do it, the stronger that muscle gets. It's not, Zazen is not about staying. Zazen is about returning. So that's our way is to be still, be quiet, and come back. And by bringing the attention back over and over again, that's exactly what William James said was the foundation of a wholesome life, the foundation of all contentment or happiness is or a sense of safety, is the ability to bring attention back. And so this open receptiveness in order to see what's actually present. Then the observer. So to be able to recognize that I can hold my awareness as an observer of my awareness and at the same time of the object of my awareness. I am not the object of my awareness, and yet I am not separate from the object of my awareness. So it's that awareness, it's a sort of knowing, this is what Siegel would call it, knowing of awareness and simultaneously the objects of awareness. So if I had been able, if I were more skilled at that, for example, when I sometimes feel like I didn't see the impact I had on someone, as I gain skills, more skill in my knowing that I'm attending to this person, and also attending to the object of my attention, which is the person's body sitting there or on Zoom or whatever, I would have a much better chance of picking up what my impact is or how my words are impacting them. And therefore, I would have a better chance of becoming more skillful over time. A chance, not a guarantee, but a chance. Without it, I haven't a chance. So I would like to be more skillful in that. So the ability to observe sort of in a inclusive way, without having to exclude either side of the interaction. And then, you know, Suzuki Roshi talked about that a lot. He talked about the wide field. You know, let your thoughts be cows in a wide field, lots of spaciousness, and observe them. So he's describing the observer. He's encouraging us to stay in our observer and to see those things as objects of mind, objects of observation, not as us. So that's exactly this teaching, said in a more Zen way. And then the third one and the last thing I'll mention is to have some sort of objectivity. And so that's in this knowing that objects of mind are objects of mind. They are not mind. They are not it. They're just objects that are constantly changing and that it are observed by this attention that hopefully through practice we can learn to guide right where we want. And we do that a lot with teaching people with chronic pain and disability and illness that will never go away. Because if the only thing we can focus on is our pain, that is not a life worth living. So the core teaching for people with pain is to learn to widen attention and narrow attention at will, so that we can use our attention, the skills of our consciousness, to create a life worth living. And as Darlene would say, you know, if you can notice 10 things in one moment, then you have not one, you have your pain and 9 other things. And that's, you know, okay. But she said, if you can notice 100 things with your refined consciousness in each moment, and one of them is your pain, then your pain becomes like a radio playing in the other room. And that's my experience. So this matter of training up awareness or training attention is like gold. I mean, it's better than gold. There's nothing on earth that can measure its value in terms of a quality life, just simply in terms of a quality life. And that's what William James was talking about, but we know it to be much deeper than that. And so my overall assessment, having read this book, and we just scratched the surface, it's a good book, by the way, but is that it's not groundbreaking. But he does offer ways to talk about these ideas that can be helpful and useful to open them up a little bit more to our ways of thinking. So presence. Thank you very much. I think I'm pretty much done. Thank you.
Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.